Good evening. What a wonderful turnout. The room is full, and it's so great to see all of you here. Thank you, thank you, and welcome to the second event of this year's Leon Panetta Lecture Series here in Leon's hometown of beautiful Monterey. This year, as you know, we're discussing the American Dream. As we noted last month, the American Dream has been a source of inspiration for people throughout the world for generations. It is what has motivated so many to come to America to give their children a better life. It is also why so many nations around the world look to America for leadership, protection, and opportunity. We all know that there can be no American dream if our nation and the global community is not secure. Today, we are facing a number of dangerous threats to our national security, from Russia to China, from North Korea to Iran, from failed states in the Mideast to wars against terrorism in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. What is the role of the United States in dealing with these crises? Tonight, we will pose the question, global crisis and the American dream, America first or America as a world leader? In the 70 years since the end of World War II, the United States has assumed a position of global leadership, building central alliances like NATO. President Trump believes that America has paid a price for global leadership, and he has promised to put America first. Can threats of global consequences be handled alone? An American foreign policy based on self-interest first is supposed to create a strong, secure, independent nation. But how does this go it alone? How does this go it alone approach work when it comes to global issues like terrorism, trade, climate change, and nuclear proliferation? In a world growing ever closer and interconnected through communication, through financing, and through security, how can America balance its responsibilities to lead others with its responsibility to protect our people? These are the questions Secretary Panetta will ask three distinguished foreign policy, defense, and political experts. Our first guest is a recognized expert on Russia, United States-Russia relations, and American foreign policy around the world. An experienced diplomat, he served for 3 years as the special assistant to the president and senior director for Russia and Eurasian affairs at the National Security Council. He was named ambassador of the United States of America to the Russian Federation in January 2012, and he served in that position for 2 years. He is the author or co-author of several books, including Advancing Democracy Abroad, Why We Should and How We Can, and the book Power and Purpose, American Policy Toward Russia After the Cold War. Today, he is a professor of political science and a Hoover Fellow at Stanford University. He is also director and senior fellow at the Freeman Spoye Institute for International Studies and a non-resident associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He received his BA and MA from Stanford University. He was awarded a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford, where he completed his Doctor of Philosophy in International Relations. Please welcome Ambassador Michael McFaul.
Wow. Thank you.
Our second...
people here.
There are. I know. It's a big turnout. It's wonderful. Our second guest is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, where she served as the principal advisor to the Secretary of Defense in the formulation of national security and defense policy, oversight of military plans and operations, and in National Security Council deliberations. She represented the department before Congress and in the media, as well as in dozens of foreign policy discussions. She has held the post of Distinguished Research Professor at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, and then as Senior Advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In 2007, she co-founded the Center for a New American Security, a nonpartisan think tank dedicated to developing strong, pragmatic, and principled national security policies. After the 2008 election, she co-led President Barack Obama's transition team at the Department of Defense. She is a former member of the President's Intelligence Advisory Board and the CIA Director's External Advisory Board. And she is currently a member of the Defense Policy Board and the Council on Foreign Relations. Please welcome back the person Leon always says could well be the first female Secretary of Defense, Michelle Flournoy. Our final guest is one of the most widely recognized writers in the world. His newspaper column has been syndicated by the Washington Post since 1974 and currently appears twice weekly in approximately 500 newspapers in the United States and Europe. He was a staff member in the United States Senate from 1970 to 1972, and was the Washington editor of National Review magazine, a leading conservative journal of ideas and political commentary from 1973 through 1976. He then became a regular contributing editor of Newsweek magazine and provided a bi-monthly essay for the magazine until 2011. In 1977, he won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary for his newspaper columns. Beginning as a founding member in 1981, he was a panelist on ABC Television's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, and then went on to appear on the program for 32 years. In 1985, the Washington Journalism Review recognized him as the best writer any subject. He was named among the 25 most influential Washington journalists by the National Journal in 1997. He currently serves as a contributor for MSNBC and NBC News. He was educated at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, Oxford University, and Princeton University, where he earned his degree as a doctor of philosophy. Please welcome George Will. And moderating our discussion, as you know, is the man who created this lecture series more than 20 years ago. From his time as director of the CIA and then as Secretary of Defense, foreign affairs and defense are areas he knows very well. Please welcome Secretary Leon Panetta.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the second forum of the Panetta Lecture Series. As you know, our theme is the American dream alive and well. Last forum, we talked about economics and the American dream. Tonight, we talk about global crisis. Why? Because frankly, so much for the American dream. The reason we talk about global crisis is because you can't have the American dream unless people are secure. And in today's world, we're facing a number of dangerous threats, from Russia to China, from North Korea to Iran, from ISIS and terrorism to Syria, from cyber attacks to nuclear proliferation, and on and on. This is a dangerous world. And the issue we need to discuss is how do we deal with those threats? How does the United States confront these challenges? Does the United States exercise world leadership as it has since World War II, or does it go it alone? How do you work both world leadership and an America First approach to these confrontations? Those are the issues that we're going to discuss with a very distinguished panel of speakers. And if you will, before I ask the first question, I would like you to join me in thanking George Will for stepping in at the last minute. I was a little nervous considering the situation in Washington that George might be appointed to something as well. But since he's not on Fox News, chances were not very good he would be appointed. Let me begin with a broad question related to foreign policy and national security. Define for me what you believe the United States' policy should be. We're obviously living at a dangerous moment. You're all familiar with the challenges that are out there. In addition to that, there's concern about a trade war with China and with our allies. There's concern about the possibility of a shooting war with our enemies like North Korea and Iran. This is a dangerous situation. What should be the approach of the United States? Should it be world leadership or America First or a combination of both? What is the approach? George?
I believe that we should embrace the inevitable, not because it's inevitable, but because it's right. And the inevitability I'm talking about is the increasing integration of the world economically and otherwise. The way we begin that, it seems to me, is with the United States Navy, which is in charge of maintaining the order of the great global commons, which is the oceans of the world. But that implies an American commitment to the free flow of ideas, goods, and services. We have gained stupendously from this as a nation. We've gained stupendously from the hundreds of millions of people drawn into the middle class in the last 30 years. Not just the populations of India and China, but those particularly, and will continue to gain. And the worst thing that could befall the United States is a great flinch, a flinch from the rigors and uncertainties and frictions and costs that are real of globalization and economic dynamism. That means we need a nation committed to technology and trade mitigation policies that help those who are hurt by these, but policies implemented because we must have the dynamism from which people might flinch.
Michelle?
I agree largely with everything that George said. I really believe the United States still has a unique and indispensable leadership role to play in the world. The only way that we can advance and protect our own interests is through engagement. When you think about the problems that Secretary Panetta listed at the front, there's not a single one of them that an individual country can solve. The only way we're going to be effective in dealing with these problems is for a coalition of countries, like-minded countries, to come together. That requires leadership. And the only country historically, in recent history, that's been able to play that role is the United States. We build the alliances, the coalitions that tackle shared problems, from proliferation to climate change to deterrence to dealing with a rogue regime. So I think that leadership's essential. It doesn't mean we have to be the world's policeman. It doesn't mean that we always have to reach for military intervention. Smart leadership means integrating all the instruments of our national power and using them wisely, informed by experience and the lessons of history.
Michael?
Well, first off, thanks for having us. I cannot believe how many people you have here. And invite me back when my book is out in May. You cannot, so I can sell some books. But first thing I just want to start with, listen to what you're hearing right here. You're listening to one of the most important conservative thinkers in America, sitting next to somebody that served proudly, I think, 4 years in the Obama administration. I served 5 years in the Obama administration, and I agree. And by the way, that's not impossible if you're trying to pursue and defend the national interest. The only thing I would add, because I do agree with everything that was said, is just a couple of things. One is, I believe in America first. I want to make America great and keep America great. That's not interesting to say. Who wants America to be 18th? I've not met that American. Actually, I've met a few of them, but
at Stanford.
Berkeley. They're not at Stanford, they're at Berkeley. You're now going to get me in a lot of trouble. I just realized this is being taped. I love Berkeley too. But we got a better football team. That's not an interesting question. The question is, how do you achieve that? And one way is to go it alone, and that I don't think our history has shown that that has been a successful proposition. Another is isolation, put our head in the sand. That also hasn't worked out well. I think the way we do it most effectively is when we lead in the world and when we engage with others in what I call win-win outcomes. It's good for them, it's good for us, and we're both better off if we're cooperating. And then sometimes, with countries like Russia, for instance, today, you have to confront them. Because no amount of diplomacy is going to lead to a win-win outcome, and we're better off confronting states that challenge our security and our prosperity in alliance with other people instead of being alone.
Let me ask you all about kind of concerns about the state of democracy in the world. We've seen growing isolationism, protectionism, nativism, nationalism, and obviously authoritarian governments have increased. As well around the world. We saw a lot of this in the early 30s, and it did not turn out well as fascism arose and we went into World War II. Are we in the same cycle, or is this something different? Michelle?
Well, I think there are certainly some common elements. If you look at the kind of warning signs that we should have seen with the rise of fascism in the 30s and then leading to World War II. And you now fast forward to today, the world is very different, obviously, but there are certain commonalities, a degradation of free press as an institution and devaluing sort of truth in the media and devaluing the reputation of the media as truth tellers. A assault on institutions, questioning the impartiality of the courts, questioning the value or effectiveness of Congress, although that's kind of an American sport throughout our history. But the sort of attack on institutions, the effort to sort of tap into people's worst fears, to get people to think tribally, like an us-them kind of frameworks, and to degrade and belittle those who are different. I mean, so there are those commonalities, and I think we see it not only, there are elements of it here happening, also parts of Europe where it's even more advanced. So I think this is a moment where we shouldn't, you know, be asleep. We should be awake to some of these developments and actively work to shore up the resilience of our institution, to enhance the quality of our civic discourse, which I applaud you. This kind of forum is exactly that kind of effort. But I really think we shouldn't be in a panic, but I think we should be concerned and actively engaged in trying to push back on some of these developments.
George, does history repeat itself?
No, but it rhymes, as the man said. I think all populisms, they come in many flavors, but they have one thing in common, and that is hostility to elites, which means the opponents of populism, of which I am one, have the unenviable task of telling people the simple truth, which is it never is a question whether elites shall rule, it always is a question which elites shall rule. And the challenge of democracy is to get people to consent to worthy elites. People don't like to hear that, but it happens to be the truth. What you just said about the comprehensive attack on the press and all the rest is an attack on the elites. But I would recommend the best book ever written on populism is an American novel by Robert Penn Warren, published in 1946, called All the King's Men. It's about Huey Long, who, take away all the varnish of sentimentality that have encrusted around his memory, erected a police state in the state of Louisiana. And it was unfettered executive power, which is what populists in the end somehow want, in spite of their rhetorical opposition to elitism. But if you read that, the question, can it happen here? It happened in one of our states. And the dynamisms, the resentments, the insecurities that enabled him to prosper first in the 20s and then more in the early years of the Depression are a lesson in what happens when this kind of rancid resentment of established institutions comes to power.
Michael?
Well, I would just add, I think it is a scary time for democracy and democratic values around the world, including in our country. Remember, at the end of the Cold War, we all assumed that democracy was the only legitimate system of government, and it was just a matter of time when the Russians were going to create that system, and it was just a matter of time when economic modernization in China was going to lead to political modernization. Those theories from 20 and 30 years ago, of which I was a part of, I confess, seem premature today. And by any measure, by Freedom House, The Economist, we have a team at Stanford that measure this, democracy around the world is eroding, both from weak democracies collapsing, of which we have many, and in liberal democracies that are less liberal today than they were a decade ago. And then add to that a new dimension of our time, that there are rising autocracies. China's the most important one, and they are presenting an alternative model for prosperity, a different model. Not like the communist one, right? A different one. You can be rich as long as you allow us to take care of the politics. Russia, Putin, it's so easy to say, oh, they're a weak country, they're marginal. But Putin today has an ideology of a strong man, a conservative, anti-elite, ironic, given that he's been in power for 18 years. And he's inspiring people in Europe, in the United States, around the world, this model. And it's a real challenge. And I don't think we fully come to grip. I mean, he's more popular to do the right thing in 9 countries that are our allies. Think about that. Japan, South Korea, and 7 more allies in NATO trust Putin to do the right thing in international affairs compared to Donald Trump. That's not a good thing if you believe in democracy being the best system of government. And I agree with what Michelle said. We have to get our heads around this and engage in this, dare I say, ideological struggle.
Let me, before I get into specific topics, talk about the process of developing our approach to national security and foreign policy. Namely, the National Security Council, which we've all participated in. Brent Scowcroft was really kind of the model that a lot of people talk about because he was a broker and he was able to present the views of the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Treasury and others that participate, and then allow the president, obviously, to have those different viewpoints, but also select different options. McMaster, tried to adopt that kind of model, unfortunately, not that successfully. Now we've got John Bolton in that position, and there's no question, you know, you clearly have a move here more to with Pompeo instead of Tillerson. It's definitely a more conservative move in terms of the National Security Council. It's a dangerous world. We're dealing with a lot of dangerous issues. George, you called John Bolton in a recent column, Bolton will soon be the second most dangerous American. Tell me how you think the National Security Council and advisor will operate under John Bolton.
Well, first, he will be down the hall from the most dangerous American, and will make him more so because he will play to his weaknesses. That is, that we know, this is not an editorial comment, we just know that he very frequently takes the position of the last sentiment he's heard on cable television or from one of his staff members. This happened just a week ago when the question was, would he sign? He'd said, I'm going to sign the $1.3 billion budget package. Someone on Fox News said, don't sign it. He said, I won't sign it. And it was just noise, but it didn't last. But it's sobering to see this kind of manipulability, if you will. Mr. Bolton does not think of himself as an honest broker between rival interests, the Pentagon, the State Department, the intelligence community, the Treasury Department. He is a player. He runs a political pack. I mean, he's a political person. That's fine. It's a free country. But that's perhaps not the job for a man who sees himself as an advocate for himself. So when you combine the fact that he does not see himself fitting the job description, which is broker between competing interests, and that he is not inclined temperamentally to be the flywheel on the president's temperament, it's an ominous combination. Leaving aside the fact that he has said that not only knowing what we know now, he would still want to invade Iraq, which he thought was on balance a positive experience, which is an acquired taste. but he also has said that the world might be more safer by a little dollop of bombing of Iran and North Korea.
Michelle, you've been there, National Security Council.
You know, I think one of the principal lessons I took away from sitting around the Situation Room table in a windowless room for far too many hours backbenching you or Bob Gates was the importance of creating an environment where dissent can be heard. There's nothing worse for a president of the United States than a rush to groupthink. It's very, very important that an environment is created where even the backbencher scowling in the corner can say, wait a minute, I think we're overlooking something, or wait a minute, have we thought about this, or wait a minute, I'm not sure, you know, we're thinking about this clearly, or that our assumptions hold. It's critical to keeping presidents from making high-stakes mistakes. And I share your concern that I don't think that is John Bolton's interpretation of his job to create that environment. I think his interpretation of his job is to use his proximity and influence with the president to push the president's decision making in the directions that he thinks are wise, and then to use the National Security Council to enforce those decisions throughout across the agencies. So the difference, you know, we've seen some ideologues in this White House, but none of them had proven themselves to be effective bureaucratic infighters and executors. John Bolton is a very effective bureaucratic infighter, and that's part of what is going to make him a dangerous addition.
Michael?
So I just say two other things. I was only in government for 5 years, so I don't pretend to be an expert like others here. But I was always struck by there were two kinds of people in the government. There were to be people and to do people. They joined the government because they wanted to be something and be in the government. And then there are other people that wanted to do things and had a firm view of what they were trying to do well before they showed up. And John Bolton, I don't know him as well as the others, but I've been on panels with him and followed. I read a bunch of his stuff in preparation for this meeting, in fact. He's got some pretty firm ideas about what needs to be done, principally about North Korea and Iran. I think those theories that he has about international relations are fundamentally flawed. If he could, I read his stuff. He couldn't convince me that bombing Iran was going to lead to regime change and nuclear disarmament. Same with North Korea. I'm just sorry. Those are flawed theories about how you deal with those regimes. But he firmly believes that. And he's not looking for a Secretary of Defense or a Secretary of State to interact in the White House Situation Room where we used to sit to kind of deliberate about what we should do. On the contrary, he wants to figure out a way to take action on his plans. And that worries me a lot.
George? It seems to me the National Security Advisor, beyond coordinating the traffic between the agencies, ought to be the person in the room who asks the three-word question, but then what? It's Yamamoto's question. In late 1940, the Japanese government summoned a distinguished admiral, Yamamoto, and said, could you take a fleet stealthily across the North Pacific and deliver a devastating blow against the American fleet at Pearl Harbor? Yamamoto said, yeah, I can design some shallow running torpedoes for Pearl Harbor itself. I can do that. He said, then I will run wild in the Pacific for 6 months, maybe a year. But then what? He said at that point, he'd studied at Harvard and loved our country, which is an amazing combination right there. And he knew that Japan would have on its hands an enraged continental economic superpower, and it was not going to turn out well. He saw the end in the beginning, and we need someone like that who sits at the back of the room and says, but then what?
Yeah, I know exactly.
Can I add one more thing? Remember the structure of the Day of the President and the PDB. John Bolton gets a shot to speak to the president every single morning. That's not something that you had the opportunity, and you had the opportunity, or I had the opportunity to do in government. He gets that shot every single day to express his views, and his office is just right down the hall.
Let's turn to some of the tough issues. Russia. Mitt Romney, at one point during, I guess when he was running for president, said Russia was the, quote, greatest geopolitical threat facing America. He was criticized for that comment. Is Romney right today?
Me?
You're the Russian expert.
Well, well, whether it's the greatest threat, I don't know where I would rank it, but most certainly Putin's Russia, Vladimir Putin and his regime, is a major challenge to American security interests and to the security interests of our ally. That is true. Now, it wasn't always the case. What gets, I think, confused sometimes, and even in 2012, I'm not sure I would have said that. But there was, Russia is not always our enemy. We are not, there's not some genetic Russian gene that predisposes them to be anti-American. I don't believe that for a heartbeat. I have hundreds, maybe thousands of Russian friends that think very differently than Vladimir Putin. And there were earlier periods in our history, both before communism and during the 90s, when we had a much more cooperative relationship with them. So it's not preordained. But today, Vladimir Putin sees us as the enemy. He sees us fomenting regime change around the world, including in his country, including me when I was ambassador. That's what he blamed me of, sitting this close to me one time. He said, I know why you were sent here, and we are going to defeat you. And he's wrong. That was not why I was sent to Russia. It was not to foment regime change against Vladimir Putin. But he has that view of the United States, and as we were talking earlier today, he believes that presidents kind of come and go in elections, but the deep state, represented by the Pentagon and the CIA and the Pentagon, they are running the show and they are anti-Russian. And there's no amount of diplomacy and tea and going to the dacha that's going to change that view. And so my tragic prescription is that we have to contain Russia, Putin's Russia. We have to confront him. and cooperate in the margins where we can. By the way, that's exactly what we did during the Cold War. It wasn't just confrontation, it wasn't just containment. From time to time, we cooperated with them on interests of, that were of mutual interest. Tragically, I think that's the formula for today.
Michelle, Russia's been very aggressive of late, going into the Crimea, Ukraine, Syria with military power, joining Assad. Obviously, the cyber attack on our election process. Add to that nerve gas, killing former Russian spies in Great Britain, developing nuclear, additional nuclear weapons, the cruise missiles, et cetera. Why, first of all, why does he feel empowered to be so aggressive? And is there anything the United States could have done to check him?
So, you know, I think that he feels empowered for a number of reasons. One is he's managed to win the support of a remarkable number of Russians. I agree with you. Not all Russia is not a monolith. There are Russians who don't like Vladimir Putin. But he's tapped into a popular sense of grievance about how Russia was treated after the end of the Cold War, about what happened to Russia since then, not being respected, et cetera. He's tapped into that sense of grievance and created a focus on, you know, the external enemy, the West, that has helped him sustain his political support, even as he's done a terrible job actually managing the country and trying to reinvigorate the economy. So that's the first thing. The second is that he has invested very strategically in his military and in other tools of power to be able to kind of dust off the old KGB playbook and not only have an impressive conventional force, but also rebuild his nuclear forces and also have, you know, little green men, information operations, cyber attacks, all the hybrid warfare tools that he seems unique in being willing to use without any kind of compunction, so any kind of constraint. I think the part of it that we're responsible for is that I don't think we've imposed real costs on him for using some of these instruments. We have fallen short in what is needed to credibly deter him, to create costs that would make him think twice, to come and meddle in our elections again, to come across a NATO border, and so forth. I think there's some areas where we're doing better, like posturing NATO to make sure he doesn't take military action against the alliance. But we've done virtually nothing that's hurt him or that's imposed any costs since the meddling in 2016. So why wouldn't we start even today to see the beginnings of Russian meddling in our 2018 elections, which is happening now? And why wouldn't we expect him to try to do even more in 2020?
George, how do we check a bully?
Well, first of all, you describe accurately what he's doing. He is dismembering a European nation. Geographically, Ukraine is the largest European nation. That's a rather big event in the post-war world. Second, it seems to me we have to understand that he has all the sense of grievance that you talk about, the sense of diminished grandeur of the Soviet, of Russia, such as it was. But he also has, as a lapsed political philosopher that interests me, he has an ideology. Mm-hmm. And it goes to a revival of traditional continental European right-wingery. Throne, altar, blood, soil, tribalism, the greatness of Pan-Slav, something. I don't understand it, but it's powerful. And the idea that armies on a march are no match for an idea whose time has come, he thinks that idea has come. He sees it in France, in Le Pen, and all the rest. He sees movements everywhere, people asserting this kind of tribal identity. That's dangerous stuff. What we do with him is we have to, first of all, make him believe that Article 5 of NATO still counts. That would be easier if there weren't polls in Germany and Britain that I know of, where there's now minority support for the proposition that's Article 5 of the NATO treaty that says an attack on one member is an attack on all. Second, I don't want to be alarmist, and I'm wary of invoking the name of Hitler, but if you read some of the speeches Hitler gave right before the Munich conference, talking about his obligation to the Germans living in the near abroad, Poland and the Sudetenland and all the rest, they're very similar to what Mr. Putin says about the aggrieved and allegedly oppressed Russians in the Baltic states. So he's got an ideology and he has a precedent.
What, just to quickly, on the election interference, when I was there, we were, you know, we were dealing with cyber, not only from a defensive point of view, but also from an offensive point of view. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand why, when we knew they were attacking our election system, we did not respond aggressively, going after, you know, using cyber to go after some of their systems as well. Yep. What happened?
Well, I was out of the administration by then, but what I understand is, I think President Obama had a couple of concerns. First was attribution took some time. By the time they really were very confident that it was Russia behind these efforts, it was very close to the election. And I think the president worried that revealing this in the fall, right before the election, wouldn't look like he was trying to put his thumb on the scale of who should win or how the election should actually, the outcome. The second is in the cyber domain, because we are the more free, more open, more internet dependent and connected society, there was huge concern about escalation. So if we used a cyber, an offensive cyber tool, what would the retaliatory measure be? And would that hurt us more and so forth? So there was a little bit of self-deterrence happening. I think one of the challenges we have as a nation is we are in a new world with cyber weapons. We have not developed the conceptual frameworks to understand what it takes to deter, what it takes to manage escalation and limit it. We need to have our conceptual frames catch up with the tools so that we will not be self-deterred in the future.
Leon, can I add one thing to that? How many people in this room have been accused on national television of being a pedophile?
I have.
Yeah. How many people in this room have been accused of and actually looked like you were giving money to an opposition in a foreign country? So what we experienced in 2016, I experienced on a daily basis in 2012. And what I want to tell you about it is, one, they don't care about the truth. The truth is not important. They're not trying to win an argument. Like during the Cold War, they were trying to win an argument. They're not trying to win an argument. What they're trying to do is sow doubt about that there's any truth. That's the first thing we don't understand, because we have some commitment, at least I think we do, you know, as a professor to the truth. They don't care at all about the truth. And number two, there's no norms about, I mean, when they put out that pedophile tape, we're all sitting at the embassy and I'm looking at my staff. Some have been working in Russia for 30 or 40 years. It's like, how can they do this? They don't care. There's no constraints. Annexation. When's the last time we had annexation in Europe? Putin doesn't care. He's not constrained. And the next wave is going to be much more worrisome. There's going to be videos of the opposition candidate saying things that are untrue that they're going to have made up. And they're going to put them out on because we're open and they're not. And I just think we're grossly unprepared for that. Algorithms. Russians are really good at math. Let me tell you. Go Google some basic things on YouTube. Google something called White Helmets one day. They're a really important NGO working in Syria. And when I do that on YouTube, the first 14 things that come up on my YouTube search are all, I would say, things that are not true. And half of them are Russian, and the other four or five are just disinformation. They're working at this game in a way that we are way behind, in my view.
Let me turn to another easy topic of North Korea. But before I turn to our audience's question. On North Korea, obviously a long history of provocation, sometimes a short history of accommodation, but mostly provocation. We've seen North Korea develop ICBMs, develop nuclear weapons, exchange of threats between both countries. Suddenly they get into The Olympics in South Korea makes an appeal to North Korea. North Korea opens up, some willingness to sit down. And then the invitation to President Trump. President Trump's supposed to meet with him sometime within the next couple months. The concern is that, we just got a new national security advisor. The process of preparing for negotiations on this kind of issue takes time, takes preparation. You've got to work through all the issues. There's no time to prepare the president for that. So what happens when the president has to sit down with Kim Jong-un? Is it just a photo op? Is it a disaster? Are they able to accomplish anything? What's going to happen with this summit? George?
Well, it seems to me the minimum that we want is far beyond the maximum they can give, which is they want to be a nuclear power for the single purpose, so far as I can tell, of guaranteeing the family regime that's been running the country since 1951. The only point of meeting them is to advance the American agenda, which is the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which is not going to happen. And it seems to me of dubious prudence to set up a high-profile meeting with all the attendant uncontrolled expectations that is bound to fail. Bound to fail. So I don't see the point of this exercise.
I think it's, if I may, sure. I think it's even worse than that, because I think it will not only fail. It will not only fail in that they won't come to any agreement on objectives or a way forward, but I fear, particularly with Bolton now in place and presumably Pompeo in place by then, two individuals who don't believe there's a negotiated solution to Korea, that military force is the appropriate action, a course of action. My fear is that the failure will be used as a, you see, we tried diplomacy, it didn't work, all of our options are over, now we're going to use force. And I do believe that there is this view among those who advocate the use of force, that there's something akin to a bloody nose strategy or a limited strike, where let's just take out the nuclear weapons facilities, take out the missiles, and stop there. Lovely idea, but totally unrealistic.
But then what?
So A, we don't know where all the nuclear weapons are, unless you found something that you didn't tell us about. The missiles, many of them are mobile, many of them are hidden. Again, very hard to be for an effective limited strike. But three, the North Korean leadership gets a vote. And this is a person who has only consolidated his power through brutality and through showing that he's the tough guy and he's willing to be provocative and use force. So the likely outcome is that he will respond. How will he respond? They have 10 to 12,000 artillery shells and short-range rockets right in range of Seoul, a city of 25 million civilians, South Koreans, Americans, Chinese, all kinds of people in Seoul. Number two, he understands by now that the best way to stop an American intervention, because we don't have everything we need sitting there and ready, we'll have to flow forces in if we're actually going to go into a conflict. The best way to stop is to divide the coalition. So he's going to threaten Japan or threaten South Korea, who may not have been fully consulted, you think, with this particular White House in this particular scenario, who might just say, wait a minute, slow down. And so he'll try to divide and conquer. And so that's my worry, that this meeting, which is very unlikely to succeed, maybe impossible to succeed in the current arrangement, will actually become an excuse for a very ill-advised and unthought-through use of military force.
Okay, let's take a quick break here.
Sorry.
Now that you're all feeling comfortable, I'd like to take a moment to recognize our question review team, the people who obviously do the selecting of the questions that I'll present to our speakers. And I'll ask you to please hold your applause until I introduce all of them. Fran Gaber, who's our veteran question review team member. Carly Mayberry, who's a reporter in Monterey Herald. Doug McKnight, a reporter with KAZU Radio. And Joe Zadowski, who's a staff reporter with the Salinas, California. If you'll thank them, please. We had a great group of students that we met with, close to 400 students, who asked all kinds of great questions to our speakers. And at this time, what I'd like to do is to ask all of the students, there are students in attendance, if those students would please stand and remain standing until I finish recognizing each of the schools that are present. There are seven schools here tonight. The Defense Language Institute, Middlebury Institute of International Studies, the Monterey Coast Preparatory School, Monterey Peninsula College, the Navy Postgraduate School, San Jose State University, and UC Santa Cruz. Great to have you. As I said, we had a great turnout, and we could not do it without the generous support of our lecture series sponsors. Sylvia and I, along with the Panetta board, are very grateful for the sponsorship that allows these students from high schools, colleges, universities, military installations, all throughout the Central Coast, to be able to come here and participate. So I would appreciate it if you would give our sponsors a hand.